Dragons and darker things, said Leo. The gray sheep have closed their eyes, but the mastiff sees the truth. Old powers waken, shadows stir. An age of wonder and terror will soon be upon us. An age for gods and heroes. He stretched, smiling his lazy smile. That's worth a round, I'd say.
Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast.
Originally founded in 2010, as two champs and a chum, we decided to rebrand when the game relaunched in the second edition. A huge thank you goes out to Fantasy Flight Games and George R. R. Martin for this game and world we love, and of course to my co-hosts and you, the listeners. Please, if you enjoy the show, leave us a review on iTunes or your platform of choice, comment on our Facebook threads, or even better, support us on Patreon. We love turning that kind of support back into the community.
This is Season 12 of the White Book Podcast.
From the third book, right? Feast of Crows?
Fourth book, but yes, Feast of Crows.
Fourth book. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, from the prologue chapter, I think it is, right? With Alaris?
The pig boy or whatever. Pip the pig boy. The guy who gets murdered and wants to, like, marry the bartender, right?
Yeah.
All right.
Props to you for remembering this stuff. Even when I choose obscure things, you're like, oh yeah, I know what that was from.
I mean, I fell into this game from the books. Like, I did not come from like a gaming background looking for a game. I sort of fell backwards through multiple steps before I found this game. So my fandom came first, and I was a very hardcore Song of Ice and Fire fan. Circa 2010 to, like, when did the season where Stannis gets killed by the Boltons come out? 2015, I think.
Maybe
14, 15, something like that.
I can't keep track of these things any longer.
Yeah, whatever season that was, then I was just like, I was definitely not someone who appreciated the end of the show as well. So,
were there people that did?
Some people appreciated some of those like later seasons of the show in general. I think it's pretty set at this point that an overwhelming majority of people didn't like where it ended. But I think I soured on it relatively early. I think, like, once Ramsay became the central villain of a good part of the show, I was kind of done with it. So I guess that would be like season 5? Yeah, season 5.
I was going to say, there were like two whole seasons after that.
I know. I got really sick of Ramsay. And then when he was the villain in the Telltale game, it was just too much Ramsay.
Yeah. And the villain in Humans, there we go.
Oh, that's right, he was.
I was wanting to call them Eternals a moment ago, but
no,
that is not right.
They're a different ageless race from Marvel Comics, yeah, created by Jack Kirby.
I would not blame anybody for getting them confused.
Oh yeah,
you described them utilizing essentially anything other than their names. They would sound the same.
They are very similar. All right, well, it's not props and slops, but it is rather regular OG White Book. So what are we discussing this week, Will?
We are on to the final official cycle of second edition, right? The King's Landing cycle. The
right.
Second Shadows.
the second Shadow Cycle, as it's colloquially known. It was also promised a new design philosophy where they would be moving away from one-to-one relationships with the books and would just be rather thematically drawing on content throughout the Song of Ice and Fire canon, well, of the five core books, because they didn't have the license to dunk an egg. Of course, this ended up being the last traditional chapter pack. So that announcement that they made when this came out kind of fell flat in retrospect, would be a fair way to say.
Yeah, I think that's reasonable.
Yeah, and I think this pack, as Will and I were sort of talking about as we were getting set up, is a high power level pack. I think, or set rather, it's not a pack. I think it's one of the higher power level packs. Of course, outside the bin pack or set rather. I've got to use the right language. I'm sorry. I'm very tired today. A very long day at work. Yeah. So this set, I think, is up there as probably maybe the most powerful chapter pack cycle.
Yeah, maybe that seems like reasonable.
Four might also be up there and as like a high spike, but there's just like such really powerful cards here that sort of distorted the last year of the game very highly, and of course have also continued to be influential in the redesign era.
Indeed.
So I think probably the most important card in this set, the chase card, the real reason to be purchasing
chapter. Chase? In LCG?
LCG, there's definitely an attempt to put desirable cards in every pack. And this isn't really something we've discussed on our retrospective, but if you look at like how they slot cards into chapter packs, they tend to like put one or two, you could call them chase cards, to like really encourage you to purchase every pack of a cycle rather than just like to try to avoid there being a dud pack. You know what I mean, Will? Where you can skip over it. But, you know, like, so most of the cards could be on the lower end of a set, but it's got Wyman. Or, for example, Kingdom of Shadows, the card I want to talk about, which is like, if you want to play Game of Thrones the card game, Kingdom of Shadows is kind of a must-buy pack. Or must-buy card.
That's the one you wanted to talk about.
I wanted to start there, yes. Well, I thought we'd start with pretty negative before we could talk about our former co-host's card.
Okay. Which, man, now you got me on tenterhooks wondering which former co-host you're talking about.
Well, there's actually I said our, and only technically one of them is both of our former co-hosts.
Okay. Touche, salesman.
All right, because I was never actually on the show with Zyler.
Yeah. Oh, spoiler alert for listeners.
Yeah, sorry. But, I mean, don't worry. I think Will forgot that Zyler's card is in this set until we talked about it at the beginning.
100%.
I don't think it's. I think Zyler may also not know that his card was in this set.
That's just straight up true.
I know Greg was aware of Knights of the Hollow Hill because he posted about it when it came out. But
Yeah. I almost thought it might pull him back in for the last little bit of things, but. Alas, it did not. So.
But we should talk actually about the troublesome card here, which is Kingdom of Shadows. I think it's not worth us rehashing our overall thoughts about Shadows, because we did go into a huge amount of depth in our previous episode about one, I guess it's now two episodes ago, where we talked about the first Shadows cycle. But Will, what do you think Kingdom of Shadows did to the Shadows mechanic and sort of how Shadows sort of expanded as an archetype and as a set, as a card pool in this final set that it's present as a keyword?
Homogenized it, I think, if I were to boil it down to one idea, right? Like this is the card that made it possible to play strictly Shadows as an archetype. with much less focus on playing, say, a Martell deck with a Shadows theme, or a Tyrell deck with a Shadows theme, or whatever. Things much more became a Shadows deck first, when you can pull virtually all of them, aside from a very kind of thin slice of draw cards, basically, is all that was loyal, right?
The draw card and the central Shadows Matters card.
Yeah,
always unique.
Your Cersei's, your Queen of Thorns, that type of thing. You did have to make a choice there, but it made it much more feel like you were playing a Shadows deck with a veneer of some house slapped onto it, rather than the kind of reverse that that Assault generated. So that's what I feel it did.
I definitely agree. I think on the surface, Kingdom of Shadows seems like an innocent design, right? It's kind of like a very boilerplate.
It's like Banner of the Shadows income.
You got me there. I guess it's plus some income, but also with a drawback, right? Like, instead of having you must include 15 cards with the Shadows keyword or whatever, they have this, you know, increase the cost of each character you marshal by one. Like, I think it's
nice to have a drawback. I feel like a lot of our talk recently has been that drawbacks virtually cease to exist on agendas. So I do at least like that.
And to be fair, it is a decent enough drawback. Like, it really does discourage you from marshaling characters. Traditionally, of course. Mm-hmm. Which can definitely put you in a tough situation sometimes. That's good, but I think the problem is it ends up being the power of that homogenous Shadows package that really develops here, and we get some of sort of the final keys of that package here, which is, you know, where is he? The Knight of Flowers is one of the critical cards. What's the other one? I think there's one other neutral, like one that was in most decks that's also in this set. You've got Knife Flyer, which is also very common. Maybe it's Jest. Is it Jest? Loras here? I guess Loras is the last one of the non-loyal ones. The rest of them are in the first cycle. I mean, I might be missing one. And sometimes you saw Knife Flyer, but I think Knife Flyer is actually loyal. No, it's not loyal. It's loyal. Okay, cool. So it's Nightflyer and Mandan Moore. Oh, there we go. Moore. I knew there was another
one. How can we forget Moore?
I knew there was another one in this set. So Mandan Moore, Nightflyer, and Loras, you know, really did sort of make this really powerful package combined with cards like Sir Robert Strong, the Martell non-unique that lets you bring things in and out of Shadows repeatedly. Like, this is just a powerful deck that really, 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 like, again, as you noted, you really just found the most abusable Shadows interaction. And that ended up being, like, Martell really got sort of priced out really quickly from this kind of, like, all-in Shadow strategy. The Shadow City really showed that it really, really was the weakest. Right, it just couldn't play ball with the power, particularly of the Lannister ones. And Lannister, of course, gets additional cards here in the form of Tunnels and in the form of Alchemist Guildhall, which is another one of the non-loyal cards. So there we go. And a very large Shadow, which is like come in and out of these Shadows packages. I always liked it, but other people, eventually, I think the version that DC played at Worlds wasn't running this card, but it definitely did see a significant amount of play. And the only thing that could compete with that was Unexpected Guile, which is just so busted, but primarily was busted kind of in a, like, I think the best thing that can be said about the mono Lannister Shadows deck, Kingdom of Shadows deck, was at the end of the day, it was a control deck. It had something like a fair strategy where if you could get ahead of it in power, it had trouble winning, right? We saw this, I mean, Glazer and I commentated a lot of tournaments in 2020 online and play and watching some of these like shadow matchups where the shadows player would end up losing because they just couldn't in 55 minutes hit 15, like their opponent got to like 12 or 13 power. And the most the shadows deck could do was get to 10 or 11, particularly if it really couldn't go off with Laura, like Luris, like if Knight of Flowers got disrupted or killed in some way, you know, the decks were just like glacially slow. I think the Lannister deck had, you know, it wasn't fair, but it sort of like was slow enough that it was its own worst enemy, I guess is a good way to put it, in winning games in 55 minutes. That was not the case of the Tyrell deck. I think the Tyrell deck, in order to be better than the Lannister deck, just had to do completely linear, unfair things. And the interaction with another card here, of course, Sparrows, which was in some of the Lannister decks as well, particularly sort of in the early days. The version of this I almost played at Thronestoberfest when I was on Team Lannister, Thronestoberfest 2019, was a Sparrows version. I chickened out at the last minute and regretted it. Yeah, I really should have played Shadows. I enjoyed playing Lannister, Valyrian Steel, another agenda we'll talk about here, but that deck was just so medium. It was like medium card on top of medium card. It just like could never catch up if it ever fell behind. But I just didn't want to play against another card that we'll talk about here, Exposed Duplicity, which was getting increasingly popular, and I just like hated playing. I mean, we could talk about it some now. Like, I hate, like, one of the things that Shadows, I think there was clearly one of the things that I guess is nice about this cycle is it did create a real escape valve for Shadows in, which is Exposed Duplicity. And people who really hated Shadows could, at the end of this cycle, hate it out. Like, I don't know, Will, if you ever played against, at tournaments, people who like their one goal of their deck was to not lose to Shadows decks.
Yeah.
So like, so they would just lose to all the Valyrian Steel players, but they would definitely beat you if you're playing Shadows.
Yeah.
Like definitely beat you.
Is that the discussion route we want to go down? I mean, cause I definitely have some thoughts on whether this type of pressure valve card is actually a good piece of a meta, but I'm willing to table that for a little bit.
Yeah, we should table for a little bit, talk a little bit more about Kingdom of Shadows. Okay. I think that it took repeated restrictions, right? It took Unexpected Guile getting restricted and that proved that the Tyrell deck was really fragile, right? I really enjoyed the Tyrell deck, but you and I both enjoy the like zone moving deck.
Yeah.
And Unexpected Guile was the most zoniest of zones. But of course, the Lannister one's not much better. But
yeah, which is probably why I loved it so much as well.
I mean, I definitely enjoyed it, but I think it kind of settled in a fundamental, like it settled in a place that really one of the things that I think I've come to understand about Thrones and power level of cards is sometimes the Thrones, particularly the restricted list in second edition, but also I think first edition suffered from this a little bit, is that they don't want to restrict the right cards, and the Lannister deck was one of the most powerful decks up to the end of the FFG era into the Conclave era and even the post Conclave era. And even though there were repeated attempts to bring the deck in line, right? Because I think Kingdom of Shadows combined with Tunnels, what's the name of the one in the core set that lets you draw cards or gain gold? What's the one in the previous cycle? The Lannister Loyal. Oh,
the location.
What's it called?
Bowels of Casterly.
Bowels. Alchemist Guildhall, Tunnels of the Red Keep, Tyrion, who is so busted, like this powerful engine, just like it has to be fundamentally broken up. It's so powerful that it took a long time to the point where it's still a solid deck, even in the much lower power level post-redesign world, right? Where they did try to nerf Kingdom of Shadows. I think Kingdom of Shadows, at the end of the day, to come around to this long ramble, and I'm sorry, Will, and I'm sorry, listeners, is that Kingdom of Shadows is just a fundamentally broken agenda that needed to be really, really, really fundamentally redesigned. And I think the attempt to sort of rein it in a little bit, the ways in which Hanno and friends did, just ended up showing that that's still not enough, to the point where I think Kingdom of Shadows is a card that probably needs to be banned or completely redesigned, because I think it's too much of a pull into the really powerful shadow synergies. And those shadow synergies are so concentrated in Lannister that you have to restrict or redesign so many cards that if you just got rid of one card, Kingdom of Shadows, and forced them to go to Banner of the Rose or Banner of the Sun, and run a bunch of garbage cards rather than the best Greyjoy cards, the best Tyrell cards, the best Martell cards, there would be much higher of an opportunity cost. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just really at the end of the day, Kingdom of the Shadows, to bring back the word I think that I was using a lot in the Greyjoy box review, is just really toxic for the game and really ended up damaging the place of shadows in the game in its final months and in its final year.
Damaging the place of shadows, just to clarify here, are you meaning like in kind of player perception?
Yeah, perception, or... yeah.
Okay.
Not in power level, because again, one of the probably the single best team to ever play this game, the DC meta, when I say team, I mean people concentratedly coming together, not necessarily individually the best single players, although Corey definitely is in any conversation about that, brought Lannister Shadows. And even though there was repeated attempts to restrict it and bring it into line, and then the last Thrones tournament that I commentated was won by a Shadows deck, even after a Kingdom of Shadows deck, if memory serves, even after the cards were redesigned and the pool was rethought on a fundamental level.
Mm-hmm.
It just, again, shows the power of these things. So do you want your point about escape valves, or do you have something that you want to...
Honestly, yeah, I was trying to think if I had anything still to add to Kingdom of Shadows at this point, and I'm not sure I do. We'll see if something else jumps out at me as we go, and I may ramble back this direction, but I think I am good to move toward kind of the pressure valve type of thing with exposed duplicity in particular. I think this type of thing does have a tendency to come up in Thrones. And honestly, it even comes up in Magic. Right. But mm-hmm. I think I'm going to say why I think this is worse than in Magic. Right. I don't have a problem with escape hatches, pressure valves, kind of meta tools to control that ebb and flow of what's strong, right? But the problem that I have is when an angle on releasing that pressure, right? The goal of releasing the pressure, I think, should be taking it from an 11 that's about to bust the system down to like a 7 that you can combat and have some interplay and some wiggle room back and forth with. But something that is so narrow and one-sided, but hits so hard along that narrow axis, plus having capability of being added to additional plot lines like the decks Roy's talking about that just decided they just wanted to bone Shadows no matter what. They could also run, you know, Barn the Gates and what's King Plot's actual name? King in the North.
King in the North, yep.
Yeah, and stuff like that where you aren't bringing something from 11 down to 7. You are like bringing it down to 0 and locking it at 0, basically. You're locking that strategy out of the game. And yes, Magic does that. You know, hate bearers are a dime a dozen, right? Granted, those are maybe a little easier to attack and find a counterplay around than a plot in Game of Thrones. But, right, that's also part of the issue here is that there is kind of some counterplay and planning and thought when you're playing best 2 out of 3. And there's a lot more back and forth there and, you know, sideboarding. You're trying to find your answers to their answers and that sort of thing that allows for that kind of self-correction, even within the context of a single, like, tournament round. In Game of Thrones, best of one, that doesn't exist. So these kind of like, I will just lock this strategy out type of answers, I think are really bad for Thrones.
I agree and disagree. I think exposed duplicity as a card that exists in, say, if you were just playing, say, Shadows with the core set plus the 2 Shadow cycles, right? I think exposed duplicity would be fine. I think a one-time effect that wipes out all cards in Shadows is fair, because what it does is it encourages the Shadows player to always think about how, like, that they could lose to expose, right? That they could be exposed, right? Well, this is similar to how the plot that did the similar thing in first edition operated, right? Which was that, you know, generally speaking, that was run when there was a lot of Shadows in the meta, and, you know, a Shadows player, you know, you played a lot of Shadows Knights, right? Had to think about that, right? Mm-hmm. And you wanted to find that there was a tension there, right? You wanted to have the cards in Shadows necessary, but you didn't want to lose your Jamie. And there was that tension of, all right, should I have Jamie on the board? But that exposes him to Valor. But if he's in Shadows, like, whatever the heck the name of that plot was, I don't remember what it was called, I could lose it, right? And that's cool. Like, I think that's a cool tension. The problem is that it existed, as you noted, with 2 other plots that made it so that in the turns leading up to this, the Shadows player could do little to nothing. Like, barring basically shut down a Kingdom of Shadows deck, and then King Plot made it so that, like, they can't really do anything productive. So what you end up happening, and a lot of their economy is shut off, like, one of the most annoying things about King in the North was that it affected economy as well. And so you could just end up in a turn where a Shadows player could, like, basically do nothing for 2 turns and then lose most of their cards. And that was just annoying. And that was just really frustrating. And I think that's what the problem was. And at the end of the day, that wouldn't be that big of a problem if the fact that King Plot and Barring were already plots you wanted to run in the meta anyway.
Yeah. So I don't think we're that far apart. I think my issue is, as you're saying, the kind of cumulative effect of this many type of answers, which makes me feel that exposed duplicity does not have a place when you're considering the field as a whole, having those other options as well.
Right. And I think that, like, exposed duplicity, you know, I think it ended up being a little too much of an opportunity cost for most high level players, unless they were, like, really scared of, like, Dragon Pit when like Dragon Pit became, like, a pretty relatively expected thing. But, like, you know, most highly skilled players figured out that Barring and King Plot were enough that they didn't necessarily need exposed duplicity, but, you know, you would still run into those decks. And there was one tournament that I played where there was exactly one person whose deck was mediocre, you could say. Except it was, it had all of the Shadows hate cards that were legal for a Stark player to play. And
they had a lot.
They had a lot. And I played them. You know, I was rising in the tournament, and I played them in the second to last round. No, no, that's not true. The last round of the tournament, I lost, but I still squeaked in on tiebreakers to in eighth place. And Will, do you want to know who the person I played in the top eight was?
Sure.
It was the
person. I was starting to guess, and then I realized you just asked if I wanted to know. So
yeah. It was the person that had just beaten me with the anti-Shadows deck. So there was like, and so I basically had the same thing happen to me that had just happened in the previous game. And that's sort of where the frustration is. And of course, we can narrate this from another side of like, you're playing a deck like Free Folk, let's pick an extreme example, that's just so cold to a Shadows deck, it can't do anything. It needs such a high roll to do anything. That's like a 80-20 matchup. Mm-hmm. But I think particularly matchups that are primarily decided by plot-based hate, I think can end up being really negative play experiences in Thrones because plots have zero variance. Other than they have skill-based variance. There are maybe bad players who could flip a important plot at a wrong time, aka me. But, you know, at the highest level, you're frequently going to just see good to medium players just play their plots properly every single game, right? And then it's just the same experience over and over again compared to draw deck hate. Like, for example, where's the big really annoying one? No Surprises, a card that I think is really poorly designed. It should be symmetrical. I don't know why a card called No Surprises still allows the Stark player to surprise people. Like, it's like a failure on a thematic and I think on a play design level, which again, for folks who don't know, play design means like a balance level. You know, this card at the end of the day is fairer than Exposed Duplicity and the strategy that goes all in on that. Because like at the end of the day, I've talked to Stark players. I played Derek, like he lost to Stark. He was playing Stark once because Derek always plays Stark. And, you know, he lost a game to a Shadows deck. And he's like, I drew one No Surprise. If I drew my second or third copy of No Surprises, I would have won that game. But I didn't. Which means, you know, that's a different game against a Shadows player than the one where he, you know, as a Shadows player, I know, you know, all right, my opponent has played two No Surprises. Most Stark decks are only running two No Surprises, and they had to have drawn the third. There's no way they have it this turn. Oh, wait, they do. Right? I've had that, right? Womp womp, right? But that's, at the end of the day, an okay experience because there are going to be plenty of games for that Stark player who doesn't have that third copy. Either they didn't put it in their deck or they don't draw it. But again, plot-based answers like this that are so locked down really end up being bad play experiences because of that you do every single game where a player has no Exposed Duplicity available to them, they will use it against a Shadows player. And that just creates these repetitive play experiences over and over again.
Yeah. No, I definitely agree that if you're looking at these types of answer cards, that the draw deck option is preferable for that same sort of variance issue. I agree. I mean, Thrones is in a tight spot to walk with that, though, right? Because of the same problem of it only being a single game match. Mm-hmm. So you want some variance, but also you want some of that mitigated, so you don't want it to be too much of a crapshoot when you don't have games two and three to try to smooth that out. So I acknowledge at least it is a tough balancing act to walk in Thrones.
It definitely is a tough balancing act in Thrones. But I think that designers for Thrones need to keep in mind with plot-based answers, the context in which they print a card like Exposed Duplicity. I think at the end of the day, Explosive Duplicity was a negative ad for this set. On both levels, in the sense that it didn't really actually end up keeping that Lannister King of Shadows deck down, but it kept a lot of medium Shadows decks out of the meta. And because of that context that we already talked about of other existing plots. So I would definitely say it was a negative addition to the game.
Okay. I think we differ on some of the particulars, but I think we both wind up in a very similar endpoint. So,
well, I think speaking of, but why don't we talk about positive additions to the game and talk about our fellow co-host's agenda.
Oh, agenda. Dang. Okay.
We're still in agendas because, again, there's three agendas we have to talk about, right?
Like, sure.
I mean, Kingdom and
I don't know why you want to skip Valyrian Steel, but yeah, okay.
You're right. Well, yes. But so Knights of the Hollow Hill, I mean, you were there for the original design of this, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, what was it in first edition? Because this is a reprint, sort of.
Yeah, reprint with a very mild redesign. Just because the original used a mechanic from first ed that didn't exist here, right? It used influence, so that had to be dropped. And I think the 3-2-1 tweak here to it, adding reserve in place of influence, upping the income over the two that it got in first edition, I think seems very reasonable of a switch to me. Honestly, one of the most straightforward things you could have done. Okay, maybe the very most was just to still keep it as 2-2-2, but sub in reserve. But with the higher gold curve in second edition, that probably would not have worked out.
Yeah, and the fact that influence was its, like, you got additional gold and additional influence, and they were both four currencies, right? So you got basically four economy points from your agenda.
Yeah. So maybe this should have been a 4-2-1, but you do lose kind of that rhythm, right? 2-2-2 had a real kind of rhythm and balance, like sense of kind of completeness to it when you looked at it. And 3-2-1 like this feels very similar. And I know that this is a very strange criteria for me to throw out there, but 4-2-1 would have really felt off to me every time I looked at the card. I'm the sort of person that won't leave a TV on 14 volume or 16 volume, that sort of thing, right? It has to be on 15. So I'm sure there are some listeners that can feel me on that type of thing.
No. I mean, definitely. But I think in game design, elegance is a thing, right? And it's something you don't want to push too much, right? You don't want at the end of the day your game to be a negative play experience because you came up with this cool, elegant design, right? But definitely elegance is a knob that's important, right? Because it creates resonance. And I think 3-2-1 creates more resonance because it was so frequently referred to as I mean, infamously, our former co-host and props and slops co-host, Aaron Glazer, would never refer to Knights of the Hollow Hill as anything but 2-2-2.
I think he actually forgot the real name.
Like, Dave Stroms, former New York City player, proto Longlands, wanted to murder Glazer because of things like this. Glazer would just start rattling numbers off. 2-2-2, 4-6-1, 7-4-2, or whatever. And, Dave would want to strangle Aaron. And Knights of the Hollow Hill is, like, the example of that. And look, to be honest with you, I had forgotten sometimes what the name is because we called it just 3-2-1, right? Because it has that sweet elegance. Probably, yes, from a balance level, 4-2-1, like, or even 4-1-1, may have even been, or even 5-1-1 may have ended up being better. They could have played with these numbers more, because I think one of the things that held Knights of Hollow Hill back was 3 economy with no setup really cost you in second edition, right? And a lot of what Knights of Hollow Hill was riding on and in first edition was this mechanic called Cards at Command, which meant the number of cards you had in play and in hand.
Didn't it also count cards in shadows?
It also counted cards in shadows, I believe, right? Because it was basically any card you could use in the in the game zone, right? The potentially or in play. You're right. I forgot about shadow about that. And there were a lot of cards that punished your opponent for having more cards at command than you. And there was a plot, for example, with Knights of Hollow Hill that you could open turn one that punished your opponent for having more cards at command than you, which they always would when you were playing Knights of the Hollow Hill. There was like almost no way for them to not, unless they also didn't set up any cards, right? And that gave kind of Knights of the Hollow Hill this like ability to sort of play catch up. Because also in first edition, there were zero cost setup, like a lot of zero cost setup cards.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So there was this tension, you know, and like, I don't remember who was the original person. It might have been like CT is the one responsible for popularizing it in the United States. But I think it was a European who originally came up with the tech, but I do not know who it was. So I apologize. But it was CT that really popularized it, of opening with unexpected delay with Knights of the Hollow Hill, to sort of like do a version of that. There was also the card you liked last time that I kind of hated on, Ravages of War, that was like kind of trying to do some of that work, but never really got there. I think Knights of the Hollow Hill really did suffer because the catch-up plots were so much worse when you didn't have a setup. I think, and this goes back to a review, our initial core set review, but something that's really been accentuated for me is second edition really shows, and this is something I plan to return to sort of at the end of our discussion here, is I think setup is actually a bad mechanic. After 5 years of playing this game, I wouldn't be surprised if Eric Lang agreed with me. I think it's a really cool thematic thing, but I think it has really, I'll steal a word from last time, toxic effects on the way in which games play. And kind of wears out its welcome over time. And second edition really, really hammered this home, with sort of the power, like the fact you set up your 7-drop or your 6-drop versus games where you didn't, you really felt the differentiation, there. And there were just fewer, because the game second edition fundamentally is designed to encourage your opponent or encourage players to set up cards like Tywin or Robert in this set, powerful 6 and 7 cards, the catch-up plots are much weaker. And so Knights of the Hollow Hill in second edition really suffers from that. That doesn't stop people from creating really cool Knights of the Hollow Hill decks, particularly the Targaryen and especially the Stark one. That was the one card that was the deck that really impressed me on a
what was the Stark one? That's not ringing a bell with my memory now.
So I think it was popularized. I think it came out of Europe, like so much in second edition. But it was played a lot in Northeast Championship Tour. It was a Stark control deck that was running like all the Stark control effects. Plus, the one that was really popular in the Northeast was also running like some power, like Stark Rush as well. So what it would do is it would use the Stark control effects and then go crazy with some rush effects to sort of, you know, flip the game really quickly. So they would, you know, hammer you with Ramses, hammer you with other Stark control effects like Ward, and then flip the game with some Stark rush. That was like really, really cool and really interestingly designed. It was a cool deck building decision that you definitely like. The first time someone flipped Stark Knights of the Hollow Hill, I was like, ooh, this is going to be an easy win. It was not.
Okay. Well, let's keep things moving then with the agendas. And the other one that Roy was ready to skip, but listeners, I fought to make sure that we talked about Valyrian Steel on this episode.
Well, Will, since you fought so hard for us to talk about Valyrian Steel, which I know is an agenda you played so much.
So much.
Like,
so
you truly much. Loved this agenda. Why don't you tell us about it?
I played so much. I have a deep and intimate familiarity with this. No. My thoughts are fairly surface level here. course, this is another returning, slightly tweaked reprint card from a previous world champion. Corey had this come out very similarly.
Well, you're forgetting, Will, that in the bin pack, the original card is there.
So. I know. I was going to get there.
Because not a reprint. Like, it's not. Because the action is different.
I mean, it is and it isn't, right? Like, because, hey, you know, for those of us that were in the know back in the day, I think everyone knows by now in that pool, or have heard from those of us that were, that Corey wanted his original agenda, the one that became Dark Wings, Dark Words, in first edition and keyed off of events. He wanted that to be off of attachments. So it was not really much of a surprise to me to see Valerian Steel come up and suddenly go, oh, okay, this is effectively the same agenda, or at least, you know, 90% of the same spirit. But he got to go back to attachments, which was what he originally wanted anyway. So I really liked that. There's a little bit of kind of back and forth here, just because it's a different era. At the time in first ed, attachments were far and away the worst card type.
Infinitely worse.
Like. Oh, so bad. So the attempt to push it with an agenda was really some interesting extra design space to explore. But through a couple of the tweaks in second edition, I think that field was flipped by the time we came around to this. And honestly, I think events needed that kind of love much more than attachments.
Yeah, I think definitely Kohor had shown the power of it, but that was kind of more of a board presence power, right? Like Kohor, even at its most degenerate, with, you know, which is that Bera deck, is like fundamentally about like board presence, or like really, really doing something like unfair that's going to close the game, right? Valerian Steel is an engine, right? That isn't really about winning you the game. It's more about powering you through the game. Does that make sense, Will?
Okay.
Right, like Kohor shows the power of attachments in controlling the board, or the power of attachments in building this Voltron that's going to take over and end the game, right? Because, you know, I'm sure you've lost a game against a Jontron deck or a Robert deck that wins that one challenge that it gets its loop going and just, you know, takes over the game, right?
Sure.
Or you've played against a Stark Kohor deck that, you know, it's jumping milks all over your people, and you're like, I don't understand this board anymore. Like, I had all these cool characters, now they don't do anything, and you've turned your bodyguard into a milk on my great character. And I was like, oh, but I can value your guy, but oh wait, you won this challenge, and then suddenly your Frozen Solid became a bodyguard back on your character, and so now I can't valor. What am I supposed to do? Right? Like, at the end of the day, that's about the board. Valerian Steel is the ultimate spin your wheel. Like, it's the ultimate, like, not spin your wheels. It's the ultimate sort of, like, electricity plant, right? It generates all the energy, but your deck needs to find your deck needs another outlet for that energy to win. Does that make sense? Because it really does a good job of drawing you cards, powering your economy, but it doesn't give you a way to win, really. And frequently, like, because it only lets you run one copy of each attachment, it doesn't, like, let you run combos very, very strongly, like, that are consistent.
Not with the attachment stuff, right. Anyway.
Not with the attachment stuff, right? And it's, in many ways, it is very much like Dark Wings, Dark Words was in first edition, right? Like, where it was this card advantage engine that you would slap on top of a mid-range deck. Right? Like, that was Kyle's beloved Stark Wink, Stark Words, right?
Oh, yeah.
Best pile of Stark cards, slap 15 events on top of it that draw you cards, and you've got a really successful deck. And that's what Night's Watch Valerian Steel is. That's what Greyjoy Valerian Steel is. That's what Lannister Valyrian Steel. I mean, every single faction had a mediocre between mediocre and excellent Valyrian Steel deck. And of course, the best Valyrian Steel deck, Night's Watch Valyrian Steel, what like is still arguably the best deck in the meta after this card was redesigned. I think no, because because what's his face was winning Tamash. What's more dangerous though about Valyrian Steel over Darkwing's Dark Words is the fact that attachments in second edition can be recycled, right?
Exactly.
Like events, unless you were really abusing Darkwing's Dark Words in first edition with, you know, some stupid stuff that lets you recycle events, you know, you played the event
and inherently
it was done, right? And it didn't lead to a situation like many Tamash games that I watched with Night's Watch Valyrian Steel. Or to be fair, like I played a lot of Night's Watch Valyrian Steel. I foolishly played it at Worlds, the final Worlds. There are times when my opponent Valored me and all of those attachments went back to my hand. So as long as I drew one character, I was drawing three cards the next turn, plus the two cards that I was, you know, going to draw anyway for my draw step. That's you're cycling through five cards. And like, I cannot tell you again, a lot of commentating in 2020 of how many Tamash games I watched where he had no board, but a pile of attachments. And if, as long as he saw a character, he was back in the game, like instantly. And the Valyrian Steel's ability to grind people out that way is really, really powerful. Particularly, again, with Night's Watch. And the reason why it pairs so well with Night's Watch is Night's Watch offers this additional win condition of the wall.
Yeah, of stalling things out.
Right. But the mid-range versions, like the pure mid-range versions, like Greyjoy, which was probably the second best Valyrian Steel deck, Will, I think that's fair, right? Had a similar game plan, right? And that is where this agenda, I think, is fundamentally different. Like, I think it would be really interesting if you could somehow do this, which is, like, have, like, Night's Watch Valyrian Steel play against, like, Stark or Greyjoy, Darkwing Stark Words in first edition, and sort of, like, see how they play against each other and, like, how those engines operate. Because I would be really interested, like, on a game design level to see sort of, like, how they operate, if that makes any sense, against each other. Because that would be extremely interesting. But I think at the end of the day, Valyrian Steel ended up being more overpowered than anyone thought. Because, in particular, it doesn't need its action. Like, the action it should not be there. Like, if I was to redesign this card, I would just delete the action, maybe put a limit once or a limit twice on it, and it'd be done. Because, like, that action just is, like, adding insult to injury in this card. And it's, like, so pushed that I honestly don't think Corey and I don't think Nate and Danny and the playtesters really appreciated how powerful the attachment card type would be when it pays off like this. Because Kohor doesn't necessarily teach the lessons, as I hope I noted earlier, that would show what the problems of Valyrian Steel would be.
Well, I mean, yeah, they kind of play they play around with a different space. I'm trying to think here how to express this type of thing. They utilize different rules, quirks about the game in different ways. So I would say that Kohor accounts for certain quirks of the game by a couple factors, one being sacrifice and the kind of built-in restrictions on that, and one being very specific and careful timing of its trigger. Valyrian Steel, on the other hand, and this may have been on purpose, it is possible, but it feels to me like it missed a quirk of the rules, which is attachments returning to hand by default after whatever they are on leaves play. So it feels to me like Kohor is planned to carefully utilize the rules of the game to try to rein itself in, while Valerian Steel is kind of powered by quirks of the rules of the game. And that is probably the issue here.
You're definitely right, but I think one of the problems with Valerian Steel is I don't think playtesters appreciated how basically, like, fully appreciated what it meant. Because I think the operating assumption that was shown in playtesting was your hand would get clogged up with these crappy attachments that you were playing because you wanted to kind of draw a card. And that eventually, like, the deck being 75 cards, running this mediocre card type that requires you to, you know, have characters in play, that all of these tension points would end up counting against the power of the agenda. And the fact that, you know, the fact that these attachments were recycling wouldn't end up being a big deal because of the clunkiness of attachments, right? And there's some truth to that. Like, again, you might not have a huge amount of, but there are times, even with Night's Watch Valerian Steel, that, like, you don't draw any attachments, right? And you've now are running a 75 card deck with no card advantage, right? Or even worse, at critical moments, you're like, okay, if I top deck one character, I win. And then you don't. And then you lose because your deck is 75 cards, right? You've been reset once, you've been reset twice. Your opponent's, like, cleared your board or narrowed it down to very few characters. You're like, if I just draw literally one character, I am in I'm golden. I got all the gas. I got three cards to draw. I've got economy. And then you don't draw that character, and you don't draw that character, and you don't draw that character, and or you need the Craven, and you've got, you know, one out of 75, right? Chance to draw. Well, not exactly, but whatever the number of cards are left in your deck. It's really a two, right, in 75. But anyway, that's not here nor there, and you don't draw that, right? There's a lot more variance, and the belief, there's a lot of theoretical tension in this card. And you definitely see that in some of the more underpowered Valerian Steel decks, you know, even the higher power ones like Greyjoy. But, you know, it's probably the least obvious in Night's Watch Valerian Steel, but it's still there. The belief in playtesting was that these tension points would end up making the card fun and fair. But it definitely didn't. It ended up fun, but definitely not fair.
Yeah. Just kind of sitting here ruminating on that difficult design balance of navigating a path between fun and what was the other term you used? I think you just said balance, didn't you?
Fair.
There we go. Fun between fun and fair. And inevitably, I think a card or a game situation that is fun for one person rarely feels fair for the opposite person in a match. So it's very difficult to work that out and have enough variety and points kind of along that scale that still keeps players engaged at kind of all points of the spectrum. And I think you really need a pretty robust, like, design and testing system to really keep that up long term. And, you know, I love everybody I've known that's been involved on either of those angles for Game of Thrones, but I think we all have to acknowledge that level has never been, you know, comparable to Wizards or what have you.
I mean, well, Wizards has 20 times the staff of...
Oh, at least.
And then every, I mean, the most important thing is that everyone who play tests Wizards games is paid to do it. Some of them are paid, you know, on a contract level where they're not making like, you know, like a living off it, but they are paid. And even if you're being paid, say, you know, $1,500 for a month's work of playtesting contract work with Wizards, that's definitely better than, you know, you're free, you got to print the cards yourself, and the cards are getting updated every week, and you have to print them yourself. Like, there's just, I mean, I will say that playtesting for FFG's LCGs was a laborious process, particularly for the people who were not their beta testers, because particularly for the core set they sent out to a few beta testers, like actually printed cards.
Mm-hmm.
But I was not part of one of those people. I don't know if you were, Will.
Not for this game. I was for Netrunner, though the printed cards were, I forget how large the sheets of paper were. It was like three sheets of like 3 foot by 3 foot paper, you know, like uncut card sheets, like you sometimes see people get as prizes.
Oh, yeah.
But it was actually.
I would love to have a Thrones like uncut sheet.
Oh, me too. Well, I used to, but the flood did that in a few years back. But it was that type of large sheet, but on regular weight paper. It was not cardstock.
Right.
So then I had to cut everything out and sleeve them with whatever other random cards I could use to back them with.
I mean, yeah, I mean, the same thing. Like when I printed cards, I had free printing privileges at the CUNY Graduate Center as a graduate student, and I just went and printed them. And then there was a paper cutter in the library, and I would just cut and then take a bunch of draft chafe from drafting first edition. And That's how I did it. Like, anyway, not easy compared to what Wizards done. So like, I definitely am willing to give, you know, Thrones and all of the FFG LCGs like a little bit more patience than you might give, you know, Wizards of the Coast. But also at the same time, I think the more you read and think about game design, it is really important to understand that it is difficult. You know, and you see that as well with like the redesigns. You know, we did a whole show about them. You know, there's ones that we thought that landed really well and ones that we felt didn't. But definitely the effort that design team put in were really great. And then, of course, that design team had, quote unquote, like infinite time and was doing it as a passion project with, you know, like they had lots of like space to do it, but they still struggled, right? Because it's hard. Designing games is hard. You know, it's a combination of art and machinery. And that's really, really difficult to find the right balance of.
Agreed. I feel like we kind of wandered far afield as we went there from the set retrospective. So let's maybe turn our attention back to some of that stuff. Do we have more in specific we want to say about Valyrian Steel, or do we move on from here?
I think we talked it out. I think we're ready to talk about probably one of the other controversial cards here.
The White Book.
No, I'm sorry. Like you and I were talking about, we've already gone an hour and we haven't even left the agendas.
At least give me, you know, 30 seconds to lament the fact
it's your show, Will.
We waited so long to have a card with our namesake and we got one and it's so terrible. I am so sad.
It's a bad card.
Bad card using a bad pool of King's cards. So,
and it was bad pool of cards. Also bad in first edition, Will. So,
we're cursed.
I mean, it's not that, like, they really have to think about the King's Guard card pool and design with intentionality, which they've sort of did in first edition.
Something else other than that?
I mean, but what else, like, I mean, now we're spending more than 30 seconds, but, like, what else is a white book, you know, I guess it could be a knight's agenda, but
it could be knights or defending in general, or it could turn people into Kingsguard, or like, I think there's a lot of other directions that it could go.
The problem is, we
don't have to go way down that path.
This is a design thing, so I think it fits here. So if I remember in first edition, the white book agenda was about defending, right? Which makes sense. But in second edition, defense is an actual house theme. So creating a neutral agenda that steals a Night's Watch theme, particularly like it's literally the theme. It's the like scream in your face theme for that faction, just doesn't make any sense. So I think in the context of second edition, you're either going to make a Knight's agenda or you're going to make a Kingsguard agenda. And for a Kingsguard agenda to land, there has to be more intentionality in the way the Kingsguard were designed, and which they were not done. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah. No, I would definitely agree.
But speaking of the Kingsguard, though, the card I want to talk about was the Iron Throne. This is one of the most controversial cards in the set. Very divisive card. We were talking about Magic. This is a very Magic design, right? Think about like Meddling Mage if we're a Magic player, or even like Pithy Needle to a lesser extent. But Meddling Mage is kind of the straight one-to-one relationship here. What do you think, Will, of the Iron Throne?
I honestly do like it. I think it is an interesting type of effect that really rewards those high skill cap players that are like deeply familiar with the meta. I do admit it winds up feeling kind of bad when they know how to laser focus and hit you at a particular time and keep you from something you need or utilize a way to see and know specifically the card. But I think the real kind of skill factor is in predicting that card just based on knowledge of the common deck building trends in the field at the time. And I think it does that in a cool way. It's in some ways, I think, very similar to the kind of plot reveal game that we've talked about before, and brings it into the draw deck playing cards. So I personally like it.
Yeah. I want to agree with you, Will. I think the problem with the Iron Throne is that unlike like an effect, imagine if this was a 2-for-2 character, that there aren't that many answers to this card, right? Like, and not a lot of factions have easy access to answers to this card, right? And so what that means is that, and it's also not just you name a card. Like, I feel like this effect, to me, is much more interesting in its, to use a Magic card, again, example, Meddling Mage, right? Where you name a card, and for the rest of the time that this card is in play, you can't play it. Your opponent can't play it. I think this affects actually both of you, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
You can even have the effect affect both players. It doesn't matter. So, you know, I play my, let's call it like R'hllor Jailer or whatever, and I say Tywin the Lannister. And you're, you know, Tywin Lannister, as long as that Jailer is in play, can't go, you know, Tywin can't come into play. Putting on a character basically means that literally every faction has a way of answering. You could even make it like a unique character. That way, you know, there could be saves, so there's additional counterplay on your end. But I think making it a location makes it really hard to answer. And then there's this whole additional, like every turn it can be something different. That I just like, I don't like that either. Because like I think while there is that high skill cap you mentioned, there's also like an exhaustion from the person playing against it, where it's just like, okay, what are they going to name this turn? Mm-hmm. Right? What are they going to name this turn? Where instead of like, I name Tywin, you know, no more Tywin. Right? Until this card leaves play. And then, with Iron Throne, it's just every turn something different. It leads to sort of choice fatigue. To be honest with you, it leads to choice fatigue for both players. Right?
It does. And that can also lead to time issues in a round.
Yes. It also... Yeah. And so I think that I appreciate what this design is trying to do, but I think that it ends up being a flawed design because it doesn't, like, it creates all kinds of, like, really unfun tensions. Some of which you noted and some of which I just noted. I think that's the standout card in the neutrals. It might be worth briefly saying that Love You, Matt Lay, I think Ghost of High Heart landed in second edition, actually. I think this is a pretty cool, it's a cool interpretation of the original card. I don't think we need to spend much time
because it's almost exactly the same, right? That it had an extra little, like, cannot be discarded text before. Otherwise, well, and little slightly tweaked cost and strength, but all the effect stuff, same.
Yeah, I think it's a really cool card. Good job, Matt, and good job, Danny, for interpreting this card for second edition.
Yeah, yeah, I think that was solid. Is there only one other champ card in this pack?
There's Zyler's card, Greg's card. I think that's it.
Yeah.
I could be wrong. Nope, I think that's it.
Okay. I just figured if we're going to acknowledge all the other champ cards, it's worth mentioning Brett's, the arrogant contender, somewhat famously, I think, was the said contender was a bit over arrogant in first ed, and was pretty unplayable in the end. And he wound up largely the same.
There was an attempt to make him better, which I do think this card's better than its second edition or first edition counterpart.
What, realistically speaking, he got a slight, like, cost and strength tweak, and he got the melee keyword spelled out instead of just having the keyword. But what changed? Wasn't the reaction essentially the same?
The reaction is essentially the same. I think that the 5-for-4 mill intrigue in second edition is an attempt to sort of, like, push it, right? In a knight, like, I think it's more playable in a knight's deck than the old one was in any knight's deck that was created. I mean, you played knights a lot in first edition, Will. Because this was a Lannister Barra card, right? A mix?
Yes. Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Right, yeah. Yeah. I think this is theoretically more playable. Because, like, it gets around for snow, which is a big problem for knight's decks.
The old one did in first edition.
Did it? Was it a 3-cost or 2-cost? For some reason, my brain is 2-cost.
It was 3. Yeah.
It was 3. And it has the intrigue icon, which knight's decks traditionally do need in second edition.
That's fair. The rearranging of the color pie, so to speak, here does make that intrigue icon more valuable than it was in first ed.
Yeah, and also being non-loyal as well, so it can be, which kind of plays into the original design, but, you know, there's more factions you can play it out of with any faction with a banner,
right,
versus just Barra and Lannister, although you could pay the gold, but I mean, paying 5 gold for Erica Contenders.
Yeah, never, ever gonna be worth it.
Wouldn't play it for 3, definitely not for 5. I think it's worth sort of, because this is definitely a set that the cycles scream extremely loudly. So I think it's worth sort of moving towards the end of our show by talking about them. And since we still really haven't left the neutral cards, let's talk about city plots. Okay. Literally every plot that isn't exposed duplicity is a city plot. So,
oh, wow, yeah. For some reason, I had thought there was one or two others that were not. Probably just because two of these have the city trait but don't start with like city, a city or whatever at the beginning.
Yeah, at the gates and Manny. Oh no, all the other ones have city in the title.
King's Landing Riot doesn't.
Oh right, see, easy one to forget.
Yeah, see,
because it was terrible.
It was not nearly as good as its predecessor.
It was not, no. So, Will, you know, why don't you tell listeners a little bit about City Plots in first edition, and what did you think?
About the first edition ones in particular?
Yeah, just, you know, you don't have to tell each one, but like,
sure.
What was its role in the meta, that kind of stuff?
So the City Plots, there's probably about three things that I can think of really worth noting about them in first edition. Number one being that they, by and large, 90% of them or whatever, all dropped in the first full cycle of the CCG, right? The first one was the one that introduced Shadows, or was the first full LCG cycle the season one? I forget now if that one overlapped was with the end of the CCG.
It was technically the first LCG one, but it was both, right? Like, they were still supporting. Like, I mean, you were around then, I wasn't.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
I think
that's fine.
I think regardless, that was the first was one with only very white order.
Early.
Yeah, early. Yes, very early.
Very, very early. And while first edition ran longer, it also had no rotation. So they were a constant issue, or maybe not issue, consideration probably is what I want to say.
Always present.
Also, yeah, always present. They had a very high power level that kept them up there. The reason they had that high power level, or at least a portion of it, is that they all built on each other in some fashion, and in a much more direct manner than these city plots do. They generally all had some type of X effect, and X was the number of city plots you had already used. So they would always scale, and you could be very flexible trading out in and out which ones you revealed when, and know that they were always going to keep getting more powerful as the game went. And the final one, which kind of goes in with both the power level and the timing and the fact that they were always a presence to keep in mind, for a long time, the only kind of starter or seed plot, the only one of them that could begin a cycle and did not need others in the used pile to push its effect, tied directly into Shadows, right? Put a couple cards into Shadows. So it was both very efficient for Shadows decks, right? You didn't want to play some other Shadows deck without that effect, because it was a very good effect for Shadows, but also because it was the only way to get the city's plot started, which had very strong and increasingly strong effects. You were already playing Shadows, so the two went hand in hand for nearly the entire life cycle of first edition. So there we go. Those are my three big ones.
Yeah, I think it's also important to... So I loved the city plots of first edition. I think they played a really important role in being powerful, and they were good answers to a lot of kind of somewhat degenerate strategies in first edition. For example, the single best location control card in first edition was cities, right?
Yeah. A late addition to cities, but yeah.
Yeah. But when I joined the game late.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
Like, because there was also later a city plot that kind of didn't do anything that was frequently used, but had decent gold. That was frequently used to start the chain. Like, I forget what it was called. It had Littlefinger art. I don't remember what it was called. But it also gave an on-ramp to new players, right? Because at the end of the day, city plots give you an opener that you always open with. So it, like, literally takes away the, like, one of the most stressful things for new players in Thrones, right? Which is, like, what do I open with? Like, what? How do I start my game? And then it creates a semi-linear game plan where, yeah, I might play my location control one, I might play my character control one, I might play, you know, my card draw one, but what turn do I do? But you always know it's going to scale, and it creates sort of choices, but it's not a huge number of choices, right? And
And you avoid the deck building or the plot deck building.
The choices. Plot deck building question, right?
Right? You mostly get that dumped on you. Sure, there were 10 or 11 of them.
Yeah, but only like six of them are playable.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
by and large, you just had your plot deck.
Yeah, you had your plot deck. And that, a lot of particularly hardcore Thrones players hated that aspect of it. Particularly those like you, Will, who've been playing since they were first printed. You know,
I didn't hate it. I loved them.
They did get
a little old when they only had the one opener. I wanted more of those. But I thought even for experienced, more in-depth players, I thought the kind of scalability was an interesting decision point when you were playing and attempting to decide, okay, is now the right moment to play City of Soldiers, whatever, the kill one, when I can kill a two strength character, or do I need to find some way to table that for two turns to be able to kill something else that I think is more likely that they're going to play as the game goes on? And I do think there was some interesting back and forth there. It's just that some of that was mitigated with the prevalence of the copy plot, right? You could blow that early still have a backup chance to do that effect.
The copy plot was a bad design decision. 100% in first edition. I think the other thing was, though, that these were pushed enough that there really was, for many decks in first edition, if you were trying to play at the highest level, like, you had to more ask yourself, well, why? This is a cool plot deck you built. And this is definitely something I learned from Dan and Dave and Glazer at the end of first edition, was like, okay, cool, you built a cool plot deck, but how much better is your deck if you're just running cities? And
probably better.
And frequently the answer is probably better, right? And then there's also rivers, which is a similar thing. I'll leave. Rivers is even more busted than cities.
That's a whole different route to go down. Thing.
But it's similar design mechanics. So there's the shadow of these is really heavy over these cards.
See what you did there.
Yeah. And it's what made these a failure. Like, I was very frustrated in play testing. And when they were printed, that cities doesn't work. It's bad.
All of these effects are very kind of slapdash. Like,
slapdash, but I mean, to be fair, we'll give our beloved Wama credit that he figured out that you could run at the gates. What was the other one? Was it City of Wealth that he would run? No, it was at the gates. Was it City of? It was at the gates, City Besieged, City of Secrets. There was one other one to make this work. It might have been Manning, the City Walls, but a City Besieged was really powerful.
Yeah.
And so, like, you could run like a tiny number of.
Or was it just double City Besieged?
It might have been double City Besieged.
Because you could run two of it, and it had two claim and high initiative.
It might have been.
I definitely remember some Greyjoy decks just ran at the gates and double City Besieged.
Yeah, and
that is.
Right, and there was, like, that was kind of like a tiny cities package that I appreciated, but, like, it meant that the rest of these cards were, like, but they weren't really cities, right? Like, it was playing off, like, if City Besieged was stripped of its sort of city-ness and was just, you know, kneel to locations, it would have just been played, right? So, like, basically all you needed to run was at the gates, which is just busted.
Yeah, which was already going to be run anyway for the search and the income production.
Right. And we'll get to at the gates in a minute. But I want to say, like, overall, I am really disappointed where the city cycle ended up being. I think this is definitely a moment where the legacy of first edition really held design back. There, like, I mean, I won't spill it. This was one of the most fought over things in playtesting. I think where we ended up, the biggest example is King's Landing Riot is nominally a really powerful reset, but is garbage.
Yeah.
Because the support, like, three.
Yeah. On three, turn four, you can do this.
Like, you get the aftermath,
and it's at the end of the challenge phase. It's, yeah, the aftermath. It's a shitty version of the
aftermath. Yeah. Right, it was at the end. It was so, like, no, it wasn't at the start.
Effectively, this is turn five.
It was really in that weird gray zone, right, between phases, right? That's what the aftermath was, right? Because it was so weird, because it was in the after. Anyway, I don't have to talk about First Edition too much. But anyway, yeah, this kind of, like, nominally King's Landing Riot is a powerful effect, but it ended up being garbage.
Yeah.
Because, again, like, you're not going to run enough city plots for City of Wealth to be any good. City of Spiders, you're not going to run enough city plots for City of Spiders to be any good.
I mean, does Spiders even scale? I mean, Wealth, I guess, it scales. Does Spiders?
Spiders, like, what is the one you want to copy? Yeah, City Besieged? You can't copy at the gates, right? Because it's a starter.
I think this is part of the, like, failure here in a nutshell. What was the problem with the first ed city plots? Well, I guess problems. There were really two. One, it was locked for so long into only having one way to start out the cycle, which really locked what type of decks could play around with them. And two, like we said, the copy plots. And what does this attempt to handle city plots do? It locks us in with one starter and then gives us a copy plot. And instead of fixing those two things that were the problems before, it embraces them and then tries to fix things by just making all of the other effects so terrible that they are unplayable. From someone that played that before, it's took all the wrong lessons from that.
And then absolutely City of Secrets is garbage. Like,
is that the discard one?
Draw two, then each player without a city plot.
I hate to say it, but there were some super janky Shaga discard decks that
right. This. I definitely,
but again, it was two copies of City of Secrets, like, by itself with no other city plots except maybe at the gates for the econ. Like, it was not it was not what city plots had previously been sold as and what these, like, hint that they want to be but fall short of.
But here's the thing, Will. Like, you and I argue with Glazer about, like, that there was a role for City of Secrets in decks that cared about the discard, right?
Yeah.
God bless that effect. Like, this effect without this, like, city rider where each player draws two cards and then they have to discard two cards would be cool, like, as just a plot. But hitting, like, eating up space in a narrow cycle of plots, this is garbage.
Yeah. Well, and it doesn't, like, if some of these effects had, like, scaled the same way, this might have gotten more interesting. Like, can you imagine City of Secrets if you're looking at, like, trying to find a way to get to, like, six city plots in your used pile or something?
You mean each player draws X cards and then, you know, discards X cards?
Yeah, like suddenly you've got this crazy Shaga game plan. You're trying to, like, draw the game out to get to that kind of point late in the game, but we didn't get that.
That's probably too busted. But it does bring us to a two-busted effect. Effect that, like, I think I might be one of the few diehard defenders of At the Gates. Because I think what At the Gates is doing is, on this, what's the best way to put this? Is, I love that it's fixing a problem of not setting up economy. One of the most frustrating things about second edition was if you have a decent setup, if you mulligan, you get a decent setup, but you don't have any economy, and then your opponent sets up economy, and you're just behind for the rest of the game, that's really, really unfun. At the Gates is an attempt to resolve that in a way that I really like. It means that, look, and it pushes the next cycle that I want to talk about, which are these one-cost gates. But the problem is a card called Great Hall. And that's where I think that this went awry. Like, this card should not have been printed with the existence of Great Hall. And, you know, Great Hall has a lot of other problems. We already talked about it. The design team did a really good job by making Great Hall unique. It still might be too good, even unique. But if this had, like, searched up, you know, a printed one-cost, limited, non-unique location, and that excluded Great Hall, I think that At the Gates would be a perfectly fine card to sit there and make sure that, the economy of all decks are going to be able to have an economy to function every game, which I think creates more fun and fairer experiences. Come for me though, Will.
It sort of does, but I think it does it in such a heavy-handed manner. One in that it kind of has some weird interaction with City Plots, and that this really literally only has to be an opener. Otherwise,
it does jack.
Yeah.
Well, it draws a card.
You put it in your hand. But also in the, if it's that important to help smooth out econ for so many decks, then now you are at the point, and one that we saw bear out, where now everyone just has a 6-card plot deck.
Yes,
that's rather than a 7-card plot deck, which kind of mucks with a fundamental rule of the game in a maybe not strictly negative way, but like in a homogenizing way. It's eliminating practical choices. You could choose not to play it, but you are actively putting yourself at a efficiency disadvantage if you do so.
Right, unless your deck.
That's where my problem is.
Yeah, I agree. And the problem, of course, is there's already a lot of equity built into plot decks, right? Like you need reset, right, as well. So it's frequently plot decks are 5 cards, right? It's pick a valor, put At the Gates in your plot deck. All right, what's everything else that you want, right? And I agree with you there. And then, of course, I can't believe I didn't mention this because it was the number one thing I was sick of At the Gates at the end of the game. The shuffle equity of this card is too high. This card prolonged so many games.
For one search and shuffle?
Both players are doing it.
Where everyone already knew what location they were getting?
Yeah, because there's the search, shuffle, you know, how many times was you pick up your deck at the bottom and then it was the top card of your deck and you're searching for the card. Oh, I found it. Okay, boom. Shuffle, shuffle, shuffle. And your opponent's doing it at the same time. Shuffle, 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 shuffle. Oh my God. Way too much. There's way too much shuffling in Game of Thrones in general. There's way too much tutoring in Game of Thrones as well. But why do you... I think I've said this before. Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but why every time that you look at the top 10 cards of your deck, why are you just not randomly putting them at the bottom of your deck? Why are you shuffling your deck? Shuffling. Why are you doing that?
You know, honestly, I don't remember you specifically asking that part. That would send me to asking, how do you randomize those 10 cards?
Well, first off, they shouldn't be 10. Be 5, but yes. So you quickly shuffle them together. That's so much better than shuffling your entire deck, cutting it, presenting it to your opponent. High stake events with very serious people who come from Magic. Maybe that's not something that you're used to in the Missouri people. But oh my God, in the Northeast. You know, by playing against Joe Mirando, it's like playing at a pro tour, right? Like you shuffle your deck, he shuffles your deck. and then cuts it. And then, like, you could tell someone like Andras who would do that, but he'd get tired by the end of the game and, you know, just start cutting your deck, right? Because, like, yeah, everyone is sick of how, like, how much you shuffle
it. Yeah. Well, and heaven forbid he's playing Trading with the Cohort and he's shuffling his own deck every 30 seconds.
Yes. Yes. Right? Like, you're just, everyone's sick of it by the end of the game, right? Like, you're just like, oh my God, oh, shuffle again. Right? Like, I would tell my opponent sometimes, I'd be like, all right, look, this is the 15th shuffle effect in this game. Like, don't worry. I trust you. Like, you, if you cheated, you cheated a long time ago.
But, yeah.
Like,
yeah,
let's just, I want, like, this game needs to end in 55 minutes. Whether it's me losing or me winning. Like, I at this point, I just went out. Right? Oh my God. So many shuffle effects. And this is a prime example of it, but because it happened literally every game, right? You just spent all this time shuffling your deck out, drawing these cards. Oh, time to go get my what's it called? Gates of the Moon.
Yep, Gates of the Moon.
Gates of the Moon, or you play the mind game. You get Gates of the Moon. I'm gonna get my Infection Gate.
Yeah, I mean you can, but I mean I guess we're potentially getting into some theory of now I forget the name of the particular theory now about like the choice of like, hey, if you do X and I do X, we both get something bad, but if you do X and I do
game
Y
theory, it's prisoner's demand a dilemma.
Yeah, maybe this prisoner's dilemma. It's been a little while since I've read those. And you get into that type of realm, but I'm definitely more in the kind of I don't know, maybe it's kind of a law of averages type of solution to it, where like if I'm going first, like if my plan theoretically is that I want Gates of the Moon and I'm going first, it's not worth the extra headspace and mind games of, oh, what is my opponent going to do and whatever. Like, I'm just going to get the Gates of the Moon and get the maximum potential outcome for myself, disregarding the outcome for my opponent. And if I'm going second, then I just get to see which they do and I choose mine accordingly. So,
yeah. And like, oh, we're getting King's Road. That's the other one.
Though I really think most folks were running at least one of their house gate for situation.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. But that does bring us, I think, to the gate cycle, which kind of is the one of the more things I like about second edition is these like attempts to create to mirror Magic. In the sense that, like, every Magic set has, like, a rare land cycle that experiments with, multicolored lands, sometimes tied to a set theme, sometimes just whatever.
I mean, even often now, common cycles, geez.
Right, to support limited, right? And, you know, what's the dual lands in the set is, like, one of the first questions you ask. And one of the things that I like about 2nd Edition, Cycle 3, Cycle 4, and Cycle 5, are like, okay, what's the economy cards in this set? And, you know, there's three different attempts to create very different economy designs. And I really want to credit Danny with that. And I think overall, the gates are successful. Where they're less successful is there's not really an attempt to keep the power level flat. And this is a complaint that you can make about the two cost ones as well. The two cost limited ones. The two cost non-limited ones, they're a little bit closer. But like, for example, the biggest one is like Iron Gate. If you're the first player, sacrifice Iron Gate to draw two cards.
Yeah.
Like that literally is gonna happen easily with very little effort by a player. Right?
Especially a Greyjoy player.
Right, especially a Greyjoy player, right? You know, but like Rivergate, if you lost two or more challenges this phase, sacrifice Rivergate to draw two cards. Like, that's, you know, not impossible for a Martell player. But like, if your opponent doesn't want to let you have that, they can let you not have that.
They can, but I do think Rivergate is a very interesting choice. When you really get into like the in-game choices involved in that, because it's two challenges of any kind, attack or defense, right? So your opponent can always elect not to attack you if they're worried about the Rivergate. And there's virtually nothing you can do about that. But you do have your own offense to throw at them. And now they're in a very interesting position where, is it more effective to deny you a draw two from the Rivergate and you lose one, I'm going to say card at command, since we brought that term up earlier, right? So you're only really netting one card and you are losing a gold out of it. Actually, you're probably losing two-ish gold out of the deal, the what you invested plus its potential income, versus them trying to awkwardly like defend but still lose, which of course gives you the claim effect, or even just let it go unopposed, which gives you power and the claim effect. I honestly think Rivergate gives a lot of interesting gameplay.
I mean, that's fair, but I think it requires gameplay, I guess you could say, in a way that Iron Gate doesn't. Like, yeah, you have to play a higher implied, or the most laughable one.
In fact, I think the gate, this one might be the only one that actually requires gameplay, right?
The others are just doesn't. Do a thing. Like, if as long as you're playing a Stark deck that isn't some weirdo Stark deck, you get it, right? It's whenever, if each character you control has a Stark affiliation, draw two cards. Right? This card's laughable. Yeah,
that's fair. That is the lowest bar for literally any of these.
You know, and it's like Night's Watch. Oh, Night's Watch got Flea Bottom.
Although
I forgot about Night's Watch.
I don't remember now if this came up in the rules. So this is a terrible time to ask this, but can you trigger Old Gate while you control no Stark characters at all? Like no characters on your
board. Let's see if this is in the rules. If you control no characters at all, you cannot trigger Old Gate's ability.
Okay, so there is a potential twist here. Oh yeah, it's right in the card entry. That's what I get for only using the rollover pop-ups.
I mean, that's what I mostly do too. I clicked on it, Will. So yeah. I mean, look,
there's a trade-off, but sure. It's still the most straightforward.
You have literally no characters in play.
You need the draw at that point.
You will say that, but like. You know, it's just a challenges action. You know, you can be like, you know, oh, I'm going to lose this military challenge. I'll trigger my Old Gate now. Okay, claim, right? That's barely. That's, but what I'm trying, and then like, you know, of the seven of these, because like the Night's Watch one is part of this cycle, but it barely.
It's functionally very different.
It's functionally very different. Like, it's super busted. But in Builders at least. Now I'm having good memories. But Iron, like, I think that they should have tried harder to keep the power level flat versus Kingsgate, you know, you have to have five or more power. That's like gonna happen at some point, but it could be the turn you win, it could be the first turn, like. And in some ways, you have some control over that, but in some ways, you don't have a lot of control.
Yeah, your opponent can attempt to push back on that a little easier.
Again, compared to some of these other ones that, you know, are basically counting cards. If you have two or more cards in shadows, you know, if you have two or more attachments, right? Again, I think that one of the problems that these economy cards based around themes suffer from with, you know, there being probably the biggest differentiation is in the two cost limited ones is that there's not an attempt to keep the power level flat.
Yeah.
Think about like, what do we want to make it so all factions have to work hard to get the payoff? Or do we want to make it so that each faction gets the payoff more or less incidentally? And, you know, you see that a lot with, because just of how powerful the two cost ones were for a long time. And these as well, like there have just definitely been times where, you know, a Greyjoy player, if they need those two cards, they're going to get those two cards. You know, you don't have a lot of counterplay. Same with the Stark one. Yeah. You know, same with the Lannister Shadows one. And that's frustrating. As much as I like this design space.
I hate to say it. I mean, I definitely agree that I like the design space in specific on the gates and in more general for these location cycles. But I feel like Thrones winds up against a bit of a rock and a hard place for these location cycles in particular, and in balancing them out, as you said. Especially, I'm thinking of this in the context of, like, I always have to keep coming back to Magic, right? It's the other thing that most folks can use as some kind of point of reference here. We've got the Strixhaven spoilers coming out now, and we've got the all the various campuses which have been spoiled as all having, was it four and tap to scry one?
Right? And there's the battlefield tap though, Will.
Right, sure, but as far as the extra ability that they have, they all have literally the same extra ability, not similar, but literally the exact same text.
Right.
For the extra part, the non-mana part. And that is a luxury, I think, that a randomized game has that an LCG does not have. If you're blowing 5 to 10 or, you know, however many faction appropriate slots on, if literally all of these gates said, like, if you have 5 or more power on your faction card, sacrifice so and so to draw 2 cards, right? That would fit the Magic type of philosophy. But in an LCG, all you've done, particularly in Throne Second Ed, is burn 7 card slots.
8.
Right? That one of those 8 should just be a neutral card.
Yes.
And the others should just be something else. So they're kind of like backed into this weird corner where they have to differentiate them in order to justify having them at all.
Right, right. An attempt to sort of do what you're saying would be Great Hall, right?
Right.
I think one of the weird design spaces that I'm surprised they never went to that is very Thrones but has a lot of commonalities is something like those zero-cost, what were they called, Seas in First Edition, right? Mm-hmm. So they were basically Rose Roads, but they were paired factions. So there was a Stark Baratheon one that, you know, you sacrificed it to reduce the cost of the next Stark or Baratheon card you played. And that's a really cool Throne-specific design space, because what it does is it, you know, if you could just play it in a Stark deck, you can just play it in a Barra deck, but if you want to play a Stark-Barra deck, it also has additional utility, and it also pushes you as a deck builder to be like, oh, Stark and Baratheon are, to get into a Magic price, allied factions.
Right.
Right. The game is going out of its way to encourage you to play those factions together. And it makes sense thematically, right? At the beginning of the books, Stark and Barra are close allies, Ned and Robert. Right. Another good example could be like Tyrell and Lannister, right? If they did one of those, right? Like through most of the middle books, Tyrell and Lannister are really important. Right, I was really surprised that that's design space that they never went to.
The dual faction stuff.
The dual faction stuff.
Yeah, oh, that's one of my favorites that I was mystified we did not get back.
Not even in characters. Like, I can kind of see why they didn't do it in characters. But with some of these location cycles, it would have been cool to have, like, you know, in cycle 4, there's the, you know, allied factions, you know, mm-hmm. where the factions that are supposed to get along and maybe their themes overlap. And then you could do a similar design with factions that don't naturally overlap. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you're pushing and pulling in different ways, you know, and you could come up with weird sort of, you could, you know, like if you can, you know, sack, like it could be, you know, if you control Targaryen, it's, you know, a Lannister location. If you control a Targaryen character or card, get an additional gold. Right.
Yeah, and they did some stuff that referenced other things like other factions like that, way back in the CCG era.
And there's some of that in remember the cycle of they were designed for the draft in first edition, but remember the characters that did that, like got a keyword if you control the Stark character, if you control the Lannister character, it got maximum strength, right?
Yeah, I think they had like two different lines, right? They kind of formed a little wedge, to steal another magic term, with the two houses on either side.
Yeah, and that was designed to push draft. Like, that is something definitely...
Or shard, I guess this would be.
Depends on if they're... Wedges are opposed factions, shards are opposed factions. But that's really magic theory. I think, more specifically, thrones. If there are, at this point, Hanno or the South Koreans or whoever's designing designing cards is listening to that, like, that is really vital design space that FFG oddly purposefully left on the shelf in second edition. That's not even getting into the potentials of these cards with characters. I think there was one more cycle I said that I wanted to talk about. Oh, that's the free events.
The free events. I thought you were going to say the Return to Shadows characters.
Oh, all of them. The Return to Shadows. Oh, right. The Bring Out of Shadows cycle.
Or Bring Out of Shadows.
We should definitely talk about those, too. Which do you want to talk about first? The sort of go back into Shadows cycle or the come out of Shadows cycle? Which do you want to do?
I mean, I like the Bring Out, mainly because I really enjoyed Mandon Moore. Always a fan of that type of...
Oh, choice. I was more thinking King's Landing Proselyte, Regent's Guard, Southron Escort, the one that you paid some additional cost.
Oh, whoops. Well, yeah, sorry. I was skipping a step here because I had been looking at Regent's Guard. That's what I get for scrolling back and forth through this list and just not opening things up in extra tabs. Sorry. Mandon Moore, I enjoy using with the Regent's Guard.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like Roy was talking about, these kind of fiddly moving zones back and forth decks that we tend to like, that right there was kind of the heart of that type of thing for Lannister. And I really enjoyed it. Part of it was this was the first Lannister kind of engine that felt potent for a long time. And part of it just felt very close to very reminiscent of first ed type of Shadows stuff to me. So I liked that.
Regent's Guard is pretty well designed, actually. I will say a lot of work went into this card. I think its restrictions are good. Right, like it can't self-recur. It's higher cost characters. Like, as annoying as Regent's Guard is, I think they actually hit with this card in a productive way.
It has enough targets to be very useful, but doesn't just let you recycle the very easy abusive ones. So
right, forming a loop with each other. Right, you have two Regent's Guards and shenanigans.
Yeah. That said, all of the rest of this cycle basically misses the mark, right?
Like, you're forgetting about King's Landing Proselyte.
Any of the rest of these?
That's the Greyjoy one. Action, kill a standing Greyjoy character to put King's Landing Proselyte into play.
Right.
And it has the most important key trait, Drown God. Right?
Yeah.
This just revolutionized Drown God in some important ways. So this is a huge addition to Drown God.
Just action, kill.
Yeah, action, kill. Yep.
Enjoy.
And it got your Vinces back into the dead pile. Mm-hmm. So you can then kill another, you just get it going. I think that is...
I mean, the other one to mention is Queen's Retinue, but that's because it missed the mark way off the opposite direction and through a rules... I want to say quirk, but that's not really it. Feature became utterly busted because There's no card memory when it goes in and out of shadows. I
mean, that's every single card game, right? Like, every single card game.
That's true. But, like, this type of effect became very busted because of that. So, yes. Like, as long as you find ways to send it back, it just keeps coming out and forces that draw.
Can I offer my hot take, Will,
on the Queen's
Retinue? People overreacted to Queen's Retinue. It was an annoying deck. It wasn't that good. Like,
no, I mean, I took it to a regional strategy championship, whichever it was that year. And I mean, it was fun. I had a lot of fun with it. But man, that was grindy and tough to really like hammer out in a tournament field.
Oh, yeah. And get to win in 55 minutes.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, I think I went to time all of my games.
And probably like, I think this is a fair statement to make. I think he's up there with Sam Bratz. I think when it comes to weird, grindy combo decks in Thrones, second edition, there's no one better than Colt Humbert. Like, you know, and Colt, like I watched Colt at Thronestoberfest 2019. Like, he didn't do that great because, and ended up missing a cut because, like, this deck was really powerful, but it was grindy and there was lots of points of disruption. And some of it was just simply like, I'm going to do my regular thing. You can see if you can grind me out while you're giving me two additional cards all the time. And I remember watching Colt play his play-in game and constantly counting his opponent's deck and just not able to get there. Because, like, there's just not enough effects to make Queen's Retinue. Mm-hmm. Like, bro, now, there's a argument for it being MPE, not fun to play against. Whatever. That's fine. Like, you can purely restrict this card, ban this card, redesign this card on a, like, we don't want this style in the game. But how it played out in the game, people overreact. That's my hot take as we move into the 17th hour of our podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking we probably ought to hit that last cycle and call it a night.
And it's a bad cycle. These are really poorly designed cards. We've already, like, I want to say this again. We said this when we talked about the two cost ones, in cycle three. Future Thrones designers, don't go back to this space unless you can only use these effects one additional time. Constantly being able to recycle these is so annoying and difficult to interact with. And yes, they're technically like frequently three cost events, but every time, like, has anyone ever seen when the Targaryen one like goes off? Like, you just like can't have an attachment in play.
Mm-hmm.
And
I mean, having Shadow Zero, I think, is probably one of the biggest issues.
Yeah. And there. It's not like summer, having a summer plot is not an opportunity cost, right? Like,
I mean, that's probably the single most prevalent plot type in the game, right?
It is up with Edict, and it's the most, it's like
nearly all the income plots.
Yeah, well, it's the one of the like this, like Edict and Kingdom, right? Those are the basic ones. Like, I think Kingdom is probably the most common. Maybe, but like,
it's,
I think
it's up there. It's fighting against summer, I'm sure.
This is really bad design space. It's both of these cycles, this cycle and the one in cycle three, or in set three, is really just bad. They shouldn't exist. Even the ones, like, a lot of these didn't land. Like, Shadow in the North didn't super land. Shadow of the Wall definitely didn't land. But that, just because they didn't land doesn't mean that, I mean, Pit of Vipers isn't this one. Shadow of the South didn't land. Like, probably the only ones that really landed was a very large Shadow and the Targaryen one. Mm-hmm. But the fact that even those two landed, and if you played against them when they went off, you're just like, why am I playing this game? Like, I'm going to have the same effect over and over and over and over again. And like multiple turns, it just creates same, like just like the sameness. Like, it's bad design space. It's just very, very bad design space that should be avoided in the future.
Yeah, I mean, you have to be very careful with anything repeatable, of course. And First Edge Shadows had a built-in limiter on shadows, right? One shadows card, the start of each phase, that would have really deeply reined in something like these effects. But it almost feels to me like they were designed for First Edge Shadows and nobody stopped and said, hey, by the way, we changed the shadows rules for Second Ed.
Yeah, I think it's also just like, I think sometimes in Thrones, there's like, Thrones designs that frequently people don't think about play patterns. They think more specifically about like play patterns in the abstract. They might think like, okay, like playing scheme plots at this point, scheme plots have been mostly outvalued. So Lannister isn't going to frequently do this. Right. Or the Tyrell one, right? Like, or the Stark one, right? Like there's some kind of opportunity cost specifically in that interaction, rather than thinking on a broader level, this level of repetitive gameplay is just bad. Right. Like just, yes, there's some kind of gate that you have to step through to get into the Elysian fields of repetitive gameplay, but just the idea that that gate is unlocked is a game design mistake in and of itself. And Thrones designers, Danny, Nate, Damon, all like in both first and second edition, but second edition really accentuated this. Like they have too much faith in their gates. And the gates don't hold up. And that leads to frequently repetitive gameplay experiences, particularly with these kind of effects.
Okay. Well, we covered a lot of ground for this particular chapter pack. And I think, honestly, or sorry, this chapter pack cycle, that is, honestly, there's probably a lot more we could say. There are other cards I'm glancing at that there are things to talk about. I think Alchemist Guildhall, the Dragon Pit,
Maester Mullen,
Maester Mullen, maybe Nightflyer. Like there are things that could be said. So I think apologize to our listeners that we're already at a 2-hour episode. I think we just don't have the time and the fortitude to go into that now. But I think part of this goes into what Roy said early about this is maybe the highest power level of a cycle, or at least it's in very small company in the most powerful ones. And so that means that there is a lot of ground to cover. So if we didn't cover your favorite aspect of this or your particular bugbear, I apologize, but definitely let us know what it was.
Absolutely. I think closing thoughts, I think that overall I like this set a lot less than the first Shadow Cycle. I think it's very uneven on power level. In the sense that, like, its highs are really high. Maester Mullen, who I mentioned earlier, a lot of the cards we talked about today. And then it also has the Maiden Vault. Right? Like,
yeah.
Or High Garden Jester. Right? Like, really low lows. The Arya in this set, right? These are, like, really, really low lows. So it makes it like a very uneven experience, right? And that's where I think it's a legitimate weakness. There's not, and a lot of these bad cards don't even fit really like Shaga elements either. They don't scream, I want to try and make this work. They just kind of like are a little bit of wet fart cards. Like, somehow, like, and this might be, and this is me being crass at the end of an episode, but this might be the fartiest set. There's extremely loud farts in the form of the high level, and then there's a lot of wet farts in the form of these, like, really bad cards that just collect even more dust in your binder.
I don't know that I've ever heard that description before, but you know, I can see it or hear it, as the case may be. Well then, I guess that definitely puts us in the danger zone.
Oh, definitely. That metaphor definitely did.
Definitely.
I'm totally thrown off by the fact that you're here, Aaron. So
what are you talking about? It's Roy. Roy is here.
Yes. All right.
See you.
All right. Oh my God. Okay.
All right. I muted him. Whether he winds up here or not, he's muted.
Wow, that totally threw me off.
Roy has no train of thought whatsoever now.
Yes, I'm not in discussing with Aaron mode. I'm not preparing my arguments to be countered by Aaron, which is how you have to when you're dealing with Aaron. But I that gets to my point. I think